This is fresh air. A lot of people don't have time to read books anymore, but they'd like to be read to. Reading aloud is enjoying a revival. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg shares some thoughts on this art.
You mightn't think it, but Sloppy is a beautiful reader of a newspaper. He do the police in different voices. That was Betty Higdon's summary recommendation of Sloppy, her young charge in Dickens' Our Mutual Friend. T.S. Eliot made the line famous when he used it in an early version of The Wasteland. The 19th century was the last great age of reading aloud. Women read to one another while they were doing their sewing. Families read to one another after supper. Cigar makers and tailors paid apprentices to read to them at work. It was a natural occupation in a time when books and candles were expensive, when literacy was limited, and when home entertainment was a do-it-yourself affair. We have livelier ways to spend our evenings now, but reading aloud will never entirely disappear, I think. That's how we first encounter books, after all, and the pleasure of being read to has an almost primordial hold on us. Of course, the circumstances have changed a bit since Dickens' time. Nowadays, the main venue for reading aloud is the highway, not the hearth, and the texts come to us courtesy of public radio or books on tape. But what's changed most is the texts themselves. 19th century literature was made for reading aloud, sometimes quite consciously. Dickens' daughter described seeing her father recite his dialogue into a mirror before writing it down. Maybe that's why Dickens' prose is reader-proof, the way some plays are said to be actor-proof. It can be read by an American or an Englishman, by a man or a woman. It can be mumbled or declaimed, and it always has the same dense exuberance. But apart from Dr. Seuss, most modern authors don't write with live voices in mind. This doesn't mean that modern fiction can't be read aloud, but the process calls for a certain diffidence. It's a delicate business, and readers sometimes get it wrong. For example, listen to Carrie Nye reading an Ann Tyler story called Average Waves and Unprotected Waters in a series of radio programs called Selected Shorts.
Arnold sat by the window. He must have thought he was going to work with her when they passed the red and gold cresses sign. He jabbered and tried to stand up. "No, honey," she said, and took hold of his arm. He settled down then and let his hand stay curled in hers a while. He had very small, cool fingers and nails as smooth as thumbtack heads. At the train station, she bought the tickets and then a packet of Wrigley spearmint gum. Arnold stood gasping at the vaulted ceiling with his head flopped back and his arms hanging limp at his sides. People stared at him. She would have liked to push their faces in.
This is also thespian, the sententious tremor and dying falls, the artful pauses, as if Nye were waiting for the words to come to her. It's as if she feels she has to do Ann Tyler, like one of those one-person shows where Hal Holbrook does Mark Twain or Julie Harris does Emily Dickinson. But Tyler's prose already has a voice, as plain and homey as Maryland soft-shelled crabs, and Nye serves it up like lobster Thermidor. This is a problem that a lot of actors have when they read aloud. They seem to feel that their public expects them to perform the text. The biggest trap is the dialogue. Here are all these characters just waiting to be brought to life, and few actors can resist the temptation to turn a novel into a radio play. For example, listen to what Judith Ivey does with a dialogue in her recording of Bobby Ann Mason's novel, In Country.
"I have to stop again, hun," Sam's grandmother says, tapping her on the shoulder. Sam Hughes is driving, with her uncle, Emmett Smith, half asleep beside her. "Where are we?" grunts Emmett. "Still on I-64. Mama has to go to the restroom." "I forgot to take my pill when we stopped last," Mama says. "You want me to drive now?" Emmett asks, whipping out a cigarette.
This is the school of reading that Sloppy specialized in, doing the police in different voices. It's fine for the Police Gazette or for a children's story, as in, "Not I," said a little red hen. But here it's a little distracting. On the page, a novelist can suggest a voice or accent with a word or turn of phrase, but when it's fleshed out like this, it can become a kind of caricature. Actually, authors are often the best readers of their own work. They usually assume that the job of storytelling is done when the last line of the manuscript's been typed, so that reading it aloud should be a purely mechanical transaction. Actors sometimes speak disparagingly of performers who merely mail in their lines, but from the author's point of view, that can be a virtue. For example, I like the way Ann Beatty reads her novel Remembering Will on cassette. At first, her voice sounds flat and affectless, but then it recedes entirely so that you have the feeling of the storytelling itself.
As his mother and Havabud sat on the front step of a brownstone, looking at small rectangular images, Will was in Virginia, staring at a peanut butter sandwich Mary Vickers had served him. He had peeled the top piece off to compare with Wag the number of banana slices each had been allocated. Havabud's lips, smacking with pleasure as he surveyed the photographs, were echoed across the miles by the sticky lips of two small boys who had been told to place the bread back on the sandwich instantly and to begin eating before Mary Vickers went stark raving mad.
In fact, I have to confess that I prefer hearing Ann Beattie to reading her. The artlessness of her voice makes a nice counterpoise to the artifice of her prose. Max Beerbohm once said that the task of a written style is to compensate for the absence of a physical voice. All the effects that the voice can achieve with accent, tone, and pacing, the stylist has to bring off with words alone. That's why a reader who supplies too much of the absent voice can unwittingly deprive a style of its very reason for being. It's just one more vindication of the universal aesthetic principle that I first heard articulated by a New York barfly named Ray the Horse. Don't romance me, just pour the drink.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California.